today on Against the Grain. It was a titanic struggle involving anarchists, socialists, communists, fascists, and the government of the Republic. It was the Spanish Civil War, and George Orwell wrote an important book about his experiences there, a book called Homage to Catalonia. I'm C.S. Adam Hochschild, who brought you King Leopold's Ghost, and who's writing a book about Orwell and Spain, joins me coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Was what happened in Spain beginning in mid-1936 a civil war or a revolution? Well, it's called the Spanish Civil War, and it did involve General Francisco Franco on one side and a democratically elected government on the other, and so people viewed it then, and to some extent now, as a struggle between fascism and democracy. And so what's revolutionary about that? What George Orwell discovered when he went to Spain in late 1936 was, he wrote, a revolution in full swing, a town, Barcelona, where, quote, the working class was in the saddle. Now, Orwell's book Homage to Catalonia is not just a description of the politics of the conflict, or I should say conflicts, it's also a memoir, an account of his experiences joining an anti-fascist militia, fighting at the front, getting caught up in internecine battles in Barcelona, and escaping Spain at a time when communists there were cracking down on anarchist elements and socialist groups deemed to be anti-Stalin. Adam Hochschild wrote a recent piece about Orwell's Homage to Catalonia in the New York Review of Books. He's also in the process of writing a book about the Spanish Civil War. Hochschild teaches at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, and his books include King Leopold's Ghost and To End All Wars. When Adam Hochschild joined me in studio, I posed the question, when Franco and his allies launched their coup attempt in July 1936, how left-wing was the Spanish Republican government they sought to overthrow?
It was a coalition government of center and left parties under what was known as the Popular Front. France had a Popular Front government at the same time. I would not say it was very left-wing. It was a coalition of a number of different parties, and some of these parties had splits within them as well. There were only, I believe, some 16 communists out of several hundred members of the coalition's forces in Spain's parliament. But the government in some ways got forced to the left during the war because the forces of the right in Europe, namely Hitler and Mussolini and their very powerful military machines, immediately came to Franco's aid. But it was not what you would call a left-wing government. Spain at this time, if we can sort of back up a little bit, was probably the country in Western Europe that was closest to feudalism. A very small proportion of the population owned almost all of the wealth. It was still an overwhelmingly rural country, but that overwhelmingly rural population only had tiny bits and pieces of land. 60, 70, 80% of the farmland was owned, by less than 1% of the population. What industry there was really concentrated mainly in two areas of the country, Catalonia and the Basque country. This was a country quite close to feudalism, probably had the highest rate of illiteracy in Western Europe, farm laborers in the countryside living at near medieval levels in hard times, sometimes being punished for stealing acorns to eat out of pigs' troughs.
Let's talk about Franco and his agenda. Was Franco initially trying to impose what could properly be called fascism in Spain?
Not exactly. Franco was a lifelong army officer. And I think his vision for Spain was really more feudal than fascist, in the sense that he wanted a Spain where the powerful institutions would be the great landed families who owned these big estates, a powerful authoritarian state, the military, and the Catholic Church. And he also had dreams of restoring Spain's lost colonial empire. It was always a little bit foggy exactly how that was going to be carried out, but it was certainly something that was very much on his mind. And actually, when, after he'd won the Civil War and was negotiating with Hitler, who wanted Franco to come into World War II on his side, Franco demanded in return a huge slice of British and French colonies in Africa if he was going to do this. So he was dreaming of empire, dreaming of restoring the glorious Spain of the old days. This was somewhat different from fascism. Fascism, as practiced in Germany and Italy, certainly didn't accord an immensely powerful role to the Catholic Church. But fairly soon after he started the Civil War, Franco consolidated the principal groups that were backing him into one political movement, which was the only political movement permitted in nationalist Spain. And there were several right-wing parties, two rival monarchist parties, and Spain's quite powerful fascist party, the Falange. And they were all forced into one single movement with Franco as its leader. And it was a state that in some ways was fascist, but in other ways, as I say, especially the role of the Catholic Church, it was not.
Now, when you say that Franco wanted feudalism, he wanted to impose or reimpose feudalism, help me understand, because, you know, you were saying that Spain was a feudal nation, or more feudal than any other nation in Western Europe. So to what degree did the Republicans, to what degree had they moved Spain beyond feudalism towards something new? And then, and that, I guess, would mean that Franco would want a return to feudalism.
Well, the Spanish Republic had not been in existence very long. There was one very, very brief Spanish Republic in the 19th century that just lasted a year or two, I think. But this Second Spanish Republic, as it was called, had only come into existence in 1931 after a very tumultuous several decades that saw a great deal of violence between left and right. And even in the 5 years or so that the Republic had lasted from 1931 till 1936, part of that time it was a right-wing coalition that was running the country. So the Popular Front government that I mentioned earlier had only come to power in early 1936, and they really had not had a chance to do very much in terms of changing the country. Franco was very hostile to anything that smacked of non-Spanish influence or foreign influence. It's amazing to see some of the groups and organizations that got targeted by the Spanish nationalists. Montessori schools, Rotary clubs, people studying Esperanto. These were all regarded as strictly subversive influences to be stamped out. Also very, very important to the regime that the nationalists imposed on Spain was the position of women. Anything that smacked of women coming into the modern age, they were against. There was, of course, no franchise for women. There was really no significant franchise for anybody for many years. Women were supposed to stay in the home. A man had the right to kill his wife if he caught her in the act of committing adultery. Women did not have the same rights under law as men did. They needed a man's permission if they were to go to work, even if they were to travel away from home for any length of time. So this is part of what I mean by trying to impose a very feudal society.
So Franco and his allies launched their attempt to take power in Spain in July 1936. How important was worker and peasant resistance to the effort to defeat Franco?
It was very important because Franco had most of the officers and men of the Spanish military with him. And parts of this were a very effective fighting force because they had been fighting colonial wars in Spanish Morocco protectorate there for many years. And indeed, both Franco and a number of his top generals were what were known as Africanistas. They were veterans of these colonial wars in Morocco, which were extremely brutal affairs. And they had the troops that fought these wars, some of whom were Arab and Berber mercenaries, known as Moors, some of whom were the Spanish Foreign Legion, which despite its name did not consist of foreigners but largely Spaniards, but often Spaniards who'd had a prison sentence commuted in return for entering the military. So this was the force with which they tried to seize power in Spain throughout the country in July of 1936. They were resisted by the elected government of the Spanish Republic, but that government had very few loyal military officers and men at their command. They did have the Navy, most of which remained loyal to the Republic. Soldiers mutinied against their officers and took over the ships. But they didn't have a trained military force. And in the early weeks and months after the coup attempt began, most of the resistance came from hastily organized militias put together by labor unions and left-wing political parties. And these were the forces that really staved off Franco's attempt to take over in most of Spain. They often had trouble getting arms because the government was reluctant to arm them at first. Sometimes when they got the arms, they didn't work. In Madrid, for example, they passed out. Finally, the government decided, well, we do have to arm these labor union and political party militias. They passed out 65,000 rifles, but only 5,000 of them had bolts. The bolts had been stored separately as a precaution, because for decades the Spanish establishment had been terrified of workers getting hold of arms. The bolts had been stored separately, and they turned out to be in a barracks that was held by the nationalists. So it was with great difficulty in those early weeks that these militias were able to get arms. But they were able to, and they were effective in stalling off the coup from being completely successful.
Adam Hochschild joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Adam teaches at the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. And a recent piece Adam wrote about George Orwell's classic book, Homage to Catalonia, appears in the December 19th, 2013 issue of the New York Review of Books. George Orwell writes that when Franco launched his uprising, the Spanish working class did not resist Franco in the name of democracy and the status quo, but rather in the name of something else. What did they want?
Well, initially, you know, there were, you know, these left political parties, because they organized the militias and their labor unions organized militias, they gained much more influence under the Republic. There was a tremendous split in Catalonia, northeastern Spain, the area around Barcelona and Aragon, which is the province right next to it. The anarchists were very, very strong. Also, a small independent left-wing party called the PUM, for its initials in Spanish, P-O-U-M, whose militia Orwell fought in when he came to Spain. These folks very much wanted a social revolution, and they really carried one out. For 6 to 8 months after the beginning of the war in northeastern Spain, there was really the most far-reaching social revolution ever seen in Western Europe, at least since the Paris Commune, and that was very, very localized in Paris. Workers took over factories, peasants took over these vast agricultural estates, waiters took over restaurants, municipal garbage trucks began sprouting anarchist slogans on the side. It was an amazing moment in history. And Orwell writes about this very movingly and vividly in Homage to Catalonia. He was only in Barcelona for a week or two, but he had his eyes open and he took it all in, as did a few other foreign visitors at a time. And it was an extraordinary moment. And this was what the anarchists and their allies wanted. And they felt it was not possible to get people to fight against Franco unless they were fighting for some sort of a social revolution, which in this extremely unequal country gave a much greater share of things to the working class. On the other side of the split were the mainstream parties of the Republic and the communists, who were rapidly gaining influence at this point. They felt that any kind of social revolution should wait until the war was won, because they were desperate to buy arms from the Western democracies, particularly Britain, France, and the largest potential arms supplier of all, the United States. And they were convinced, sadly, probably correctly, I think, that the U.S., Britain, and France would never sell arms to a Republican Spain they perceived as revolutionary. As it happened, the U.S., Britain, and France never sold arms to Spain anyway. But it was not an unreasonable thing, I think, to feel, you know, well, we ought to hold off on the revolution until we can win the war. But this was an extremely strong conflict, which erupted in bloodshed at one point within the Spanish Republic.
And I want to return to this issue, this topic, in some detail over the course of this hour. But let's talk about anarchism in Spain at the time. So you said that anarchists were sort of in the ascendancy, were sort of in power in Catalonia, in Barcelona. How deeply rooted was anarchism in Spain, in the Spanish context?
It was quite deeply rooted. Anarchism had its day and largely disappeared in most of the rest of the world. It had been a fairly significant force, you know, towards the end of the 19th century and very early 20th century. Then it lost influence almost everywhere else, but it remained extremely strong in Spain. Exactly why, I'm not sure I know. There is some degree of communal tradition, communal land ownership among villagers in northeastern Spain, communal ownership of certain kinds of things in fishing villages on the Spanish coast. But for one reason or another, anarchism took root and became extremely strong in that part of the country. And there are many things about Spanish anarchism that one can feel enormously sympathetic to. The idea that workers should control their workplace, people should control the community that they're in, that democracy should be as direct as possible. There are other aspects of it which seem, to say the very least, peculiar and impractical to me. Anarchists had a very strong feeling that the problem with repressive regimes everywhere, whether it was Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia or anywhere else, was not the nature of the government, but rather the fact that there was a government at all. And so they believed in the abolition of all governments. And they believed in the abolition of paper money, that everything should be done on a basis of barter and exchange. Well, some of these things, I think, are not too practical to put into effect in a very complex industrialized world, much as one can empathize with many things about the spirit of anarchism.
So the anarchists must have been, in a sense, delighted by what was happening in 1936, to the extent that there was a kind of power vacuum, there was a relatively weak Republican government, and they could kind of do what they wanted. They could begin this social revolution, as you said, in places like Catalonia. Could you talk more about what was going on and what Orwell observed and what his impressions of what he observed were?
Well, when Orwell arrived in Barcelona in December of 1936, he noticed, first of all, that on the street, nobody was dressed up. Nobody wore coats and ties. Nobody wore hats. Everybody seemed to be in working class clothes. And he wrote, you know, for the first time I had the experience of being in a town where the working class was in control. I'm not sure whether he interpreted what he saw correctly. I think there were a lot of people who were not necessarily working class, but knew that in this kind of atmosphere that prevailed, you shouldn't go around in a coat and tie if you happen to have one. Nonetheless, there was an extraordinary spirit there, which other visitors testified to as well. Everybody, you know, Spanish is one of those languages where there's an informal second person singular that you use in talking to friends, and a more formal second person singular you use in talking to other people. Everybody used the familiar form. Nobody said Mr. and Mrs. It was always camarada or compañero. And he observed things like the famous Ritz Hotel in Barcelona with its monogrammed china and fancy chandeliers, and you can see photographs of this, threw its doors open to the public and put the tables together in long rows and turned itself into a cafeteria for working class families and the poor. You know, churches were turned into refugee centers, hospitals, and so forth. The anarchists were very, very hostile to religion and burned or destroyed many churches, put others to other uses, and actually killed many priests and nuns. They were extremely anti-clerical. So this was a quite extraordinary moment. And one of the many things that draws me to Orwell's writing about Spain and in Homage to Catalonia is that he observed this and was fascinated by it and is almost alone among foreign journalists who were in Spain at that time in even bothering to see and write about this. You can read everything written by the, you know, the famous American glamour couple Ernest Hemingway and Martha Gellhorn, other American reporters who were there at the same time, and people never stop to observe, mention this amazing moment in northeastern Spain during these few months. There were, over the course of the Spanish Civil War, an estimated 1,000 or so foreign journalists who were there for, you know, almost none of them for the whole time, but for periods ranging from a few weeks to many months. Not a single one of them bothered to embed himself or herself in a farm or factory or restaurant taken over by its workers for even a few days and see what it was like. How was this dream working out in practice?
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Adam Hochschild joins us. He is the author of many books, including King Leopold's Ghost, Bury the Chains, and most recently, To End All Wars, A Story of Loyalty and Rebellion, 1914 to 1918. We are today talking about the Spanish Civil War and George Orwell, who wrote about that war in his book, Homage to Catalonia, which was published in 1938. So, how then do we explain the way in which Orwell covered and wrote about the war in a way that was different than the other people you've been talking about, the other journalists? What was it about his political sensibilities in the mid-1930s? He arrived in Spain in December 1936 that perhaps made him more aware than other writers of what was going on politically in Spain?
Well, Orwell had a very cranky, independent spirit, and he came to Spain on his own. He didn't come in a group, and he didn't have his eye on the competition. He came to Spain to fight, because within a day or two after he'd gotten there, he had volunteered for the militia and was in training, and a week later was sent to the front.
And I imagine Orwell's take on the situation was influenced by his socialist ideas, right? It's often called democratic socialist perspectives that he had developed growing up and in England.
I think so. He was a supporter of something called the Independent Labor Party in England, which was loosely affiliated with the party whose militia he fought in Spain. And, you know, the militia he was in was organized very much along democratic lines, where their, you know, officers did not wear special insignia or get paid more than the soldiers they commanded. So the army was run on a quite egalitarian basis. And, yeah, he was politically predisposed to be very interested in this kind of experiment in social revolution that was going on in Spain that time. At that time, I think he was also deeply influenced in what he wrote by the fact that he was there when the situation came to blows. In May of 1937, he was in Barcelona on leave during the time of what's known as the May Days, when there was street fighting in which an estimated several hundred people were killed between the anarchists and their allies on the one side and the mainstream parties and the communists on the other. It was the latter group which prevailed, and anarchist influence after that point was much diminished.
Adam Hochschild is his name. He teaches at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Adam about the Spanish Civil War and about George Orwell's classic book, Homage to Catalonia. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Adam Hochschild joins us in studio. He wrote a recent piece called Orwell, Homage to the, quote, Homage, in the December 19th, 2013 issue of the New York Review of Books, Homage being George Orwell's book, Homage to Catalonia, which was published in 1938, which I think was a year after he returned from fighting on the Republican side in the Spanish Civil War. So if we could return to what you were saying about the communists in Spain actually being against the social revolution going on there. I read somewhere that the communists, well, one account has it that the communists were in fact the most energetic force pushing the anti-social revolution approach in Spain. Is that true?
I think it is, although they certainly shared these opinions with the mainstream parties. And in part, they were in turn being heavily pushed by Stalin, because the international situation was something that had enormous effect on what was happening in Spain at this time. The outbreak of the Spanish Civil War caught the Soviet Union totally by surprise. Stalin, who by that point was an absolute dictator there, was deeply alarmed. He didn't want another country in Europe that would be allied with fascist Italy and Germany against him. At the same time, he desperately was trying to build alliances against the Nazis and the Italian fascists with Britain and France. So he didn't want anything to happen in Spain that would upset Britain and France. And he knew that if Spain was perceived as a revolutionary society, this would be the case. And he wanted Republican Spain to survive, and he fairly quickly began sending them a significant amount of armaments, military advisors, and so forth. But he absolutely did not want the Western countries to perceive it as a revolutionary society. And so orders went to Spanish communists, you know, put the brakes on anything like what's going on in Catalonia. And they did.
Well, one thing that Orwell decried in this book, Homage to Catalonia, is that the Spanish communists didn't just put the brakes on the revolution, but they did something to the gains that workers had made since July 1936, since the beginning of the coup attempt by Franco. What attempts were made and were successfully achieved to roll back workers' progress on the various fronts that you've been discussing?
Well, the Republican government restored to foreign owners, for example, foreign-owned plants that had been taken over by their workers, as had been, for instance, the Spanish subsidiaries of Ford and General Motors. They didn't want to alienate foreign investors because, in turn, they didn't want to alienate the governments of the democracies from whom they were desperately hoping to be able to buy arms. Ironically, Republican Spain had the money to buy arms because they had the world's fourth largest gold reserves. But Britain, France, and the United States refused to sell them arms, as did a number of smaller Western countries under the influence of those big three. And they had nowhere to turn except the Soviet Union. And it was the Soviets who got almost all their gold as a result.
One thing I found interesting, and maybe a lot of people don't remember, even if they've read Homage to Catalonia by George Orwell, is that Orwell early on says that he preferred the communist line. He found it more pragmatic. He agreed with them that revolutionary chaos might sabotage the effort against Franco.
He did, and ironically, when he was in Barcelona in May of 1937, it was with the aim of transferring from the sector of the front where he'd been fighting, which was very quiet, to the international brigades, which were the units organized by the world's communist parties, which were fighting for the defense of Madrid. And he felt that was the part of the war that really mattered, and he wanted to transfer to those units. He then, however, got very disillusioned with the communists when he saw that not only did they suppress the social revolution that he admired, but they did so accompanied by a huge pack of lies, charging that the PUM, the party whose militia he fought in, was a secret ally of Franco, and that they had been sending Franco secret messages about troop dispositions and so forth. And he knew all this stuff was not true. And I think it had a powerful disillusioning effect on him. And we can see the results of what it did to his mind in a book like 1984, which he published some years later, where you have the Ministry of Truth and its all-powerful control of the propaganda apparatus.
And what did Orwell notice at the front? Because he went to the front twice. He had a stay in Barcelona in the middle of it. But what did he notice about, for example, the arms that were or were not making it to the front that colored his perception, that affected his perception of the communists and the communist strategy?
Well, he noticed that the PUM and anarchist units were not getting the best arms. They were getting ancient rifles that weren't much good, very few heavy weapons of any kind, which he assumed were all going to the units under communist control. Everybody assumed this, and to a large extent it was true. What is less well known is this, that even though Stalin sent a lot of arms to Spain in return for the gold that Spain sent him, a lot of arms to Spain in late 1936 and throughout most of 1937, and even though the best of the arms went to communist units, Stalin was clearing a huge amount of superfluous and antiquated junk out of his warehouses of weapons. Soviet Russia had probably the world's most varied arsenal of weaponry, result of what it had inherited from the Tsars, what it had confiscated during the Russian Civil War. And only in recent years, when the Soviet archives became partly open, was a very good British arms historian named Gerald Howson able to get into these archives and get the lists of actually what were the weapons that were sent to Spain and see some of the correspondence. There's one remarkable letter from Marshal Voroshilov to Stalin saying, now's the chance for us to get rid of all that old junk that's been cluttering up our warehouses. So not all of what Stalin sent to the Spanish Republic was worthwhile or particularly helpful in military terms. Some of it was. Without fighter aircraft and tanks that the Russians sent them, the Republic would have been beaten much earlier.
Adam Hochschild joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Adam teaches in the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, and he's in the process of writing a book about the Spanish Civil War, and he wrote a recent piece about George Orwell's classic book, Homage to Catalonia, which is about Orwell's time in Spain during that civil war. You can read that in the December 19th, 2013 issue of the New York Review of Books. So in this book, Homage to Catalonia, Orwell makes the claim that if the Spanish Republican government had appealed to the workers of the world in the name not of, quote, democratic Spain, but of, quote, revolutionary Spain. In other words, if the communists and the mainstream parties had not had their way and the social revolution had gone forward, he claims that it is hard to believe that they, the Spaniards, would not have gotten a response in the form of millions of workers in other countries taking action like strikes and boycotts in support of the Republican side. What do you make of that claim?
Well, looking at Orwell's work as a whole, one of the things that impressed me as I read Homage to Catalonia for the fourth or fifth time in my life was that Orwell was somebody who was not afraid to change his opinions. One of the remarkable things about this book, and I think it's one of the great works of nonfiction of the 20th century, is its humility. He says several times, I'm telling you what I saw, but I saw only a small corner of events. He uses that phrase. Other people may have seen more. This may not be the whole truth, but I'm trying to report the truth as I saw it and experienced it. Now, when he was there and when he was writing this book immediately after coming back from Spain, he took the line that you just quoted, saying that if Spain had only remained a revolutionary society, Spaniards would have rallied better to the Republic's cause and workers all over the world would have joined in strikes and boycotts and brought pressure so that the Republic would have won and Franco would have been defeated. I think he was wrong about that. And I think to his great credit, he recognized that he was wrong about that some 5 years later when he wrote a long essay called Looking Back on the Spanish War. And in that essay, he said very clearly that he decided it was not these divisions in the Republican camp which lost the war for Spain. Said the outcome of the war was decided in Rome and Berlin, Paris and London. Rome and Berlin because these were the countries, Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy, that were supplying such an enormous number of troops and weapons and modern aircraft and so forth to Franco. Paris and London, to which he should have added Washington, because these were the countries that were refusing to sell arms to the Spanish Republic. So I think he changed his opinions about this. I think when he wrote Homage to Catalonia in 1938, he still shared the belief of many people on the left throughout the world that the working class was potentially a revolutionary force. My own feeling is that the working class had shown that it was not the revolutionary force that radical intellectuals hoped for, starting in 1914, when the workers of Europe joined up enthusiastically into the armies of the rival sides of World War I and slaughtered each other in appalling numbers. The workers of the world certainly did then and do now deserve a far greater share of the world's wealth than they have, but I don't think they were quite the revolutionary force that radical intellectuals have always hoped. By the time that Orwell wrote that essay looking back on the Spanish War in 1943, 5 years after he'd been in Spain, I think he'd come to that same conclusion.
What conclusions did he draw about war in general from his time in Spain? Did he agree with those who've written about war as a glorious endeavor?
I don't think so. One of the wonderful things about Homage to Catalonia, I think, is the nitty-gritty way in which he captures what it's like to be on the front lines in a war like that. The smells, the feel of walking around in wet boots all the time, the boringness, one of the very few episodes of combat. He describes a night raid on some enemy trenches. He's extremely honest about how terrifying it was, how confusing it was, how impossible it was to figure out really what was happening. It's anything but the glorious cavalry charges that military historians love to write about. There's an astonishingly beautiful passage, I think, in Homage to Catalonia, where Orwell describes how after he was wounded and withdrawn from the battlefront, he was on a trainload of wounded soldiers who were being sent to hospitals behind the lines. And everybody had bandages and crutches and so forth. And at one point, they found themselves pulling into a station. And on the opposite track, right across from them, there was a trainload of fresh troops who were heading off to the front with big artillery pieces strapped onto their railroad carriages and so on. And all the wounded soldiers crowded to the windows and waved their bandaged arms and their crutches out the windows. And the soldiers on the other train cheered. And he said, watching this, it was almost possible to believe for a moment that there is something glorious about war after all. But the fact that he says almost possible, I think, means he was somebody who no longer believed it.
In fact, I underlined that passage in my own copy of George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia, so I'm going to briefly read it. Quote, "It was like an allegorical picture of war, the trainload of fresh men gliding proudly up the line, the maimed men sliding slowly down, and all the while the guns on the open trucks making one's heart leap as guns always do, and reviving that pernicious feeling so difficult to get rid of, that war is glorious after all." That's George Orwell. And my guest in studio is Adam Hochschild, who teaches at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. Okay, so when Orwell leaves Spain in 1937, there's a lot of tension in the streets of Barcelona. There's a lot of suspicion. In fact, Orwell writes about the quite real possibility that spies might be sitting in cafes across from him. This is when the PUM, P-O-U-M, the political party whose militia Orwell joined in 1936, is banned by the communists and the Republican government, and people are being thrown in jail. So we have Orwell worried about spies being around and him being spied on. Was, in fact, Orwell being surveyed during his time in Spain?
He certainly was. By this point in the war, the Soviet Union essentially controlled the military intelligence service of the Spanish Republican government. And one of the amazing resources that that historians have now is we can look at some of their records. Before the war ended, all these records were taken back to Moscow, where they remained locked up for more than half a century. Then after the Soviet Union collapsed, the Russians realized there was a lot of money to be made by selling microfilms of this stuff to Western libraries. And I spent some time in the library at New York University, where they have something like 180 microfilm reels of these Soviet records. And you can see the reports of people who spied on Orwell and other foreign leftists who were allied with this PUM party, which was a particular bugaboo for Stalin, not because it was a large and influential group, but because it had split off from the world communist movement, and therefore Stalin, in his very paranoid way, considered it to be traitorous. And so we can see the reports that some of these folks wrote. At one point in Homage to Catalonia, Orwell describes in a very colorful way how his wife's hotel room was raided by half a dozen policemen who spent, 2 hours going through the place and taking all of his note. He himself was not there. He was in the hospital having his wound treated. But from his wife's hotel room, they took all his papers and notebooks from his first 4 months at the front, the couple's correspondence, letters, papers, checkbooks, everything. Now, the actual stuff that they took is believed to still be in a locked file in Moscow, but you can look at today in the files that are accessible a complete list of what they took from the hotel room, which somebody very dutifully typed out.
And Adam Hochschild, as you reveal in this New York Review of Books piece, Orwell, in a sense, didn't stop writing Homage to Catalonia after it was published in 1938. Years after, he wanted changes made to its contents. What revisions did he want published?
Well, the changes that he wanted reflected his feeling that he had paid too much attention in the book to the suppression of the PUM and to these divisions on the Republican side. He came to feel more and more that the war had been decided by the fact that the Western democracies refused to back the Republic, and Hitler and Mussolini very heavily backed Franco. And so he requested a number of changes, mainly that two long chapters that dealt with this internecine fighting in Barcelona, which he'd taken part of, be relegated to appendices. This doesn't unsay anything he said in the book, but it gives it a very different political emphasis. And he left detailed instructions for this. They were actually made when the book was published in French a couple of years after his death, because he'd been corresponding with his French translator about this. But they weren't made in English, and they weren't made in England until some 35 years after he died, when at last, in the 1980s, the book was published in the form in which he wanted it. And they've never been made in the edition that's on sale in the United States.
And why is that?
I think perhaps the publishers had either had lost this correspondence where he requested these changes, or they didn't know it existed. And it wasn't until his complete works were edited. This is a big 20-volume set of his complete writings. It wasn't until they were edited in the 1980s and 90s that, and it was very well done by a scholar named Peter Davidson, that he discovered, no, Orwell had asked for these revisions. They'd actually been made in the French edition. At that point, the British publishers put out an edition in the correct form. Also, the book, like many of Orwell's writings, had been used as a weapon in the Cold War. And I think people wanted to point to Homage to Catalonia, and you can see it to some extent in the introduction to the American edition, which is written by Lionel Trilling, where he talks about, you know, this book was a record of Orwell losing his illusions, and it's a testimony to the perfidy of communism and so forth. Well, to some extent this was true, but I don't think Orwell had that many illusions to begin with. But I think it was convenient throughout the Cold War for people to use this book, just as they used Animal Farm in 1984, as Cold War weapons in a sense. And to forget that Homage to Catalonia has many, many readers and admirers on the left. For my generation of people who were activists in the 1960s, a lot of us who were civil rights workers in the South, you know, this was a book that we carried with us. It was a record of a man who had risked his life for what he believed in.
Part of Homage to Catalonia is a critique of the world media, the global media, the mainstream media. And what Orwell really didn't like, among other things, was this portrayal of the Spanish Civil War as a conflict between democracy and fascism, civilization and fascism, leaving out the social revolution going on, which he found incredibly interesting and enlivening. Which leads me to the question, why didn't the Western powers help and supply arms to the Spanish Republic if that was the message, if the message was as simple as, here are the democratic forces, here are the fascist invaders, intruders, why didn't the U.S., for example, come forward and overtly or covertly help the Republic?
Well, I think where the United States was concerned, President Roosevelt, even though he was certainly extremely opposed to fascism, was very, very wary of getting sucked into a European war in any fashion. Remember, this is only a decade and a half after the First World War ended, a war that was absolutely catastrophic for Europe. and Roosevelt didn't want the U.S. to get sucked into another war. There was no powerful constituency arguing in this country for strong support for Republican Spain. And there was a pretty strong, not exactly constituency, but interest group, namely the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, that was arguing vigorously for a complete embargo on arms going to both sides. They knew the U.S. would never sell arms to Franco, but they certainly didn't want it selling arms to the Republic. They were very much rooting for Franco to win. So I think Roosevelt felt that if he helped the Spanish Republic by letting them buy American arms, he would get a lot of flack from the Catholic hierarchy, and it would not gain him any political support. And he didn't, at the time, 1936, 37, 38, see that supporting the Spanish Republic could have been a way of sending a message to Hitler. By 1939, he realized he'd made a mistake, and he told a cabinet meeting after the war in Spain was lost, said, "We made a terrible mistake."
Well, it's interesting that George Orwell, at the end of his book, Homage to Catalonia, after seeing all the madness and all the deprivation and the suffering and coming to grasp the politics, the infighting, almost the self-sabotage going on within some of the anti-fascist forces, that he writes that, quote, "the whole experience has left me with not less but more belief in the decency of human beings." Does that surprise you?
No, it doesn't, because here was a man who went to fight to risk his life for what he believed in. And I think something that was very inspiring to him in Spain, which he writes about, is how moving it was to see so many other people, not just from Spain, but from other countries as well, who had come there willing to risk their lives for this cause. And I think there is always something deeply moving and inspiring when you see people who have come a long way at great risk because of what they believe in. And this seems to have been the feeling that he took from Spain that remained with him for many, many years afterwards.
Adam Hochschild is writing a book about the Spanish Civil War. He's the author of King Leopold's Ghost, Bury the Chains, and To End All Wars. And his work has appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's, The Nation, many other publications. You can read a piece he wrote about George Orwell's book, Homage to Catalonia, in the December 19th, 2013 issue of the New York Review of Books. He teaches at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. Adam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, CS. It was a pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting, as Albert Einstein once did, that the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is produced by C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. You can also check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. That's Against the Grain Radio on Facebook.